2018 marks the 25th anniversary of the Broadway debut of Angels in America.
It was an incredibly terrifying disease, and it was particularly destructive to the world of theater, because theater had always been a haven for queer people.
Angels in America won the Pulitzer Prize, swept the Tonys, and changed the way queer folk were represented in popular culture.
Angels in America is the greatest work of post-war American literature or drama.
Isaac Butler talks with me about the oral history of Angels in America and what this play has done and is doing still today for America.
It is a call for us to think about the nature of citizenship and who gets to be a citizen and who doesn't, and to rethink that more expansively, more empathetically, and more bravely. That is what the play is calling for us to do at the end.
It's time for Progressive Spirit. First, the news. Progressive Spirit is produced every week. It couldn't happen without the financial support of my congregation, Southminster Presbyterian Church in Beaverton, Oregon. Southminster's website is www.southmin.org. Progressive Spirit is produced in the studios of KBOO in Portland, Oregon, for the Pacifica Radio Network, and PRX, the Public Radio Exchange, as well as podcast. Show KBOO some love, won't you? KBOO.fm, and click donate. For the Pacifica Radio Network and the Public Radio Exchange, and from the studios of KBOO in Portland, Oregon, this is Progressive Spirit. ProgressiveSpirit.net. I'm John Schuck.
Until this play, there really was no major work of drama, literature, or film where the person who had AIDS at the beginning of the story was alive at the end of the story. And the idea that this story could end with that character still alive, even though he's fragile, he's worse off, he might not be alive for that much longer, but that he is alive was a really, really bold statement, and a statement of hope that a lot of people needed to hear.
Isaac Butler and Dan Coys take us backstage and behind the scenes of the iconic play, Angels in America.
You know, there is no way you're going to write about the AIDS crisis particularly, and about gays in America, and not cover specifically the Christian faith in America.
Their book, The World Only Spins Forward, The Ascent of Angels in America, is an oral history telling the story of the play and its influence from the voices of over 250 actors, actresses, and others who have given Angels in America its wings over the past 25 years. From the Reagan era to the Trump era, Angels in America is still on the threshold of revelation.
Oh boy, does it ever. You know, one of the interesting things was that when we started reporting the article that would turn into this book, Donald Trump Was a Joke, we got about halfway through working on the book and he was the next president of the United States, you know? And that radically changed the book. I think it radically changed the nature of the book. Our interviews with people went from people kind of talking in abstract terms about the relevance of this play today to people talking in direct concrete terms about the relevance of this play today. The play was not written at a time of great positive change. The play was written and takes place in a time when things are terrible, but there's glimmers of hope. There's little shoots of grass, you know, peeking through that sort of concrete that's been laid over it. And that is very similar to the time we live in now.
Isaac Butler is a writer and theater director, most recently of Real Enemies, which premiered at the Brooklyn Academy of Music. He is the co-author of The World Only Spins Forward, The Ascent of Angels in America, with writer and editor Dan Coys. From New York City, welcome Isaac Butler to Progressive Spirit.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, tell me, first of all, overall, about Angels in America. What about it demanded so much of your time and energy to write this book?
The short answer is that Angels in America is the greatest work of post-war American literature or drama, I think. The longer answer is that both Dan and I had our kind of lives changed in our late teens by seeing the play when it was on Broadway first in 1994. We both had this experience. We didn't know each other at the time, of seeing both parts of the play and just having this kind of epiphanic maybe almost religious experience where, you know, that the world had changed, that our horizons had been broadened, that someone had come forward and demonstrated how really great politics and really great art could braid together masterfully. In ways that would, I think, define both of us as human beings and as writers ever since. And so when the 25th anniversary of Angels in America's premiere at the Eureka Theater in San Francisco was coming up, Dan pitched an article about the history of Angels in America to Slate. He's an editor at Slate. And it was, you know, they greenlit it. And he very quickly brought me on board because he realized very quickly it was a huge project. We began working on it as an oral history immediately. We sort of never questioned that format. And one of the interesting things that happened as we dug into it was that every single person we talked to, whether they were in a production in college or they were in the movie or they were one of the original actors who had been in the show or they did the lights or whatever, every single person we talked to about the show had a similar life-changing experience of being involved in the show. And so it was this kind of huge totemic thing for a lot of people. And as we worked on it, it just became clear that the story was too big for just an article. So we did that article. It's a good article. It's a very long article. It's about 15,000 words long. But our original draft for that article was 40,000 words long. And the book is about 120,000 words long. So that gives you some sense of how big the project already was before we had sold it as a book or started working on it as a book.
Tell me about the structure of the book.
The first half of the book, it's in kind of five acts, you know. So the first half of the book, the first three acts are take you from the dawn of the AIDS crisis and Kushner having the idea for the play through the play being commissioned, him developing the play, its early workshops, its first couple of productions on the way to Broadway and its Broadway premiere. And then the second half of the play, second half of the book, deals with the fallout from that. It deals with the making of the movie. It deals with a failed attempt to make the movie by Robert Altman in the 90s. All these sort of different productions that are reimagining the play and kind of what happens to the play once it becomes a widely taught, you know, canonically placed, you know, capital G great work. And then it ends with the production at the National Theatre in London from last year that is also the current production on Broadway. So it ends with people who are currently working on the play talking about what it's like to work on the play. And then interspersed throughout that are a series of interludes. There's one interlude for each character in the play. And each of those interludes features as many actors as we could get our hands on who had ever been on the show on any level talking about that specific character, whether it's, you know, Roy Cohn or Prior Walter or Louis Ironson or, you know, any of the characters, and talking about sort of the key moments for those characters. And you get to see the sort of large interpretational debates about the characters in the play play out in this very practical way as artists talk about how they approach the part.
My wife and I just saw it again. I hadn't seen it probably for about 10 years. And when I say see it, I'm only talking about the HBO version. I haven't seen the play. And I would imagine that's probably the biggest audience. I don't know. Maybe not. Well, tell me a little bit about the difference between the HBO film and, say, one of the early or the Broadway edition when it first came out.
Sure. You know, what's interesting about the HBO film is how faithful it is to the text. You know, one thing Tony Kushner said to us in an interview is, you know, Mike, meaning Mike Nichols, Mike really wanted the play. You know, he didn't want Kushner to do a lot of adapting in the play. He wanted to work with the play and film the play. So there are some sort of, you know, there are some longer monologues that are a little bit shorter. You know, there's some trims here and there. There is a little, very subtle coda added for the character of Joe Pitt, who is played by Patrick Wilson in the HBO film. So the big difference in the film is that it has a lot of incredibly famous people in it, right? Meryl Streep and Al Pacino and Emma Thompson and stuff like that. And simply the difference of moving something from being on the stage to being, you know, a realistically shot film. So you have a lot of close-ups, you use editing, you know, you're looking at the small nuances of human behavior. And you do that instead of getting the sense that you get in when you go to see a play, that we're kind of all in this shared space watching this event unfold together. One of the effects of that is that the movie, or the, I guess it's a TV miniseries, is not as funny as the play is. Because when you when you see the play live, what I think sort of gets lost in that version a little bit is that when you see the play live, it is one of the funniest plays you will ever see. But a lot of the humor of it really relies on there being an audience there all together watching it.
Now, and there's also a difference when I was reading in your book, and I can't remember which person was saying this, but the part of the difference also was by the time the HBO film came around, that obviously the situation had changed a great deal in terms of AIDS, obviously, in terms of acceptance or at least talking about it. And so there's an almost a sense in which some of the later versions, including perhaps the TV version, really kind of didn't quite have that same sense of the radical aspect of the early versions of the play.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's definitely the cultural context definitely shifted between when it was first on Broadway or first being written and when it was on HBO. In between the Broadway run in 93, 94 and the HBO miniseries in the early aughts, you have the widespread adoption of what are called the triple cocktails, which are the drugs that, you know, if you respond to them, and if you're lucky enough to be able to get them and everything like that, are the drugs that can make HIV a manageable chronic illness that is actually fairly difficult to transmit rather than a death sentence. And that has radically changed the AIDS crisis. It's radically changed the discussion around AIDS in this country. I mean, it really changed a lot of things. Also, the other thing that happened is, in part because of Angels in America's, you know, run on Broadway, the way that people with AIDS and gay people, particularly gay men, particularly effeminate gay men, shifted radically in our culture, and the representational norms around those kinds of characters and those kinds of stories completely changed. And Angels in America was absolutely part of that and a driving force in that cultural shift when it was on stage. And so in a weird way, it reaps the benefits of that a decade later when the HBO film comes out. I would say, having just seen it on Broadway, you know, there's a Broadway revival now, and so I just saw it recently.
Yeah.
You know, the politics of that, the representational politics of Angels in America might not feel as radical as they did when it was pushing back against something. I don't know. But the politics of Angels in America are, writ large, are just as huge, just as controversial, just as forward-thinking, just as radical as they were when the play first debuted on Broadway. And if anything, those cultural shifts allow us to see those other kinds of politics that are lurking in the play.
Talk a bit about the play itself, Angels in America. For those who may yet not know what it's about, can you give a plot summary?
Well, I mean, yes, I should preface this by saying any plot summary of Angels in America is doomed to failure. It's two plays. The first is called Millennium Approaches. The second is called Perestroika. So it's a play in two parts. Seeing the whole thing takes 8 hours with a dinner break. You know, it's a huge, huge story. So this is going to butcher it a little bit, but to try to do it, Angels in America takes place largely in 1986, 87, and it takes place in New York City, and it concerns a gay couple, Pryor Walter and Lewis Ironson. And when Pryor is diagnosed with AIDS, he has Kaposi's sarcoma. He reveals this to Lewis, and Lewis, after struggling with it for some time, leaves Pryor because he's unable to handle Pryor's illness. Then there is another sort of couple. There's a kind of a central quartet in the play, and the other half of that quartet, also in their, around 30 years old, is Joe and Harper Pitt, who are Mormons who have moved to New York City so that Joe can work in the appellate court system as a clerk. Joe Pitt is a closeted gay Republican Mormon, and his kind of denial of who he is poisoning his life and driving his wife crazy. And Harper is an agoraphobic pill-popping, she pops Valium throughout the play, who hallucinates and kind of has these prophecies and is afraid to go, outside into the world. And then the other characters in the play are Pryor's nurse, Belize, who is also one of Pryor's best friends, who's an ex or maybe XX drag queen and is African-American and gay. An angel, Joe's mom, Harper Pitt, and perhaps most relevantly to politics today, the real-life figure of Roy Cohn is a character in the play. And a lot of people have forgotten who Roy Cohn was, but Roy Cohn was a lawyer in the who helped prosecute Ethel and Julius Rosenberg and made sure they got the chair. He was involved in the HUAC with McCarthy. He was one of McCarthy's part of McCarthy's crew as a lawyer, and then he went into private practice where he represented a lot of mobsters like John Gotti, and also represented and became a mentor to our current president of the United States, Donald Trump. He was a Republican fixer, power broker, extremely powerful behind the scenes mover and shaker, whose career was destroyed when he contracted AIDS, which, also outed him as being gay. And there was a story that sort of outed him as someone who had AIDS and was gay, and he died not that long after that story came out. And so you see sort of his journey from diagnosis through the death. He's kind of this stage devil figure. He gets like all the best lines, and he's very entertaining, but he's also this repulsive figure of evil.
He is bully, coward, victim. That was said about him on the AIDS quilt.
That's right. Yeah. Yep. Yep. There's an AIDS quilt panel for Roy. And it says Roy Cohn, bully, coward, victim. And, one of the things that Kushner really had in mind when he was making the character and that he struggled with was how to embody that whole dialectic, how to make him a bully, a coward, and a victim all at once.
And do you feel that Tony Kushner kind of got the real Roy Cohn right?
Nathan Lane says in the book that Kushner's Roy Cohn is probably smarter and funnier than the real guy, right? Yeah. I mean, it is very much a stage creation. It says in the foreword to the play that this is a fictional creation. I mean, among other things, I believe, if I remember correctly, the real-life Roy Cohn went to Walter Reed in DC for treatment, whereas in the play he's in New York City at St. Vincent. So there's a lot of stuff that's changed about him. At the same time, I think there is an essence and a truth at the core of Roy that Tony Kushner captured.
And of course, the essence and the truth of what Roy represented in many ways. The person, as he says, and you quoted in the book, and I remember the wonderful line where he says, "I'm not a homosexual. Homosexuals, don't know anybody, and nobody knows them. I'm me." So there's an essence in which art can really bring even the deeper sense of an everyman quality to all of these characters.
Yeah, absolutely. And, speaking of everyman, I mean, one of the really powerful things that this play did was it was an epic story about the very nature of America. And at the heart of that story are gay people. And its protagonist, its everyman figure, is an effeminate gay man with AIDS, who at the time, that they were starting to write this, is like sort of one of the most despised overlapping subclasses of people in the United States, right? An effeminate gay man with AIDS. And not only did Tony Kushner make him the center of the play, the heart of the play, the protagonist of the play, our stand-in in the play, no matter what your own identity is. The other thing that he did that's really radical is that Prior Walter, that character, is still alive at the end of the play. And until this play, there really was no major work of drama, literature, or film where the person who had AIDS at the beginning of the story was alive at the end of the story. And the idea that this story could end with that character still alive, even though he's fragile, he's worse off, he might not be alive for that much longer, but that he is alive was a really, really bold statement and a statement of hope that a lot of people needed to hear.
I'm speaking with Isaac Butler, if you're just joining us on Progressive Spirit. He's the author of The World Only Spins Forward, The Ascent of Angels in America, along with Dan Coyce. And that the play back on Broadway until what? Till this summer?
Yeah, I can't remember when its run ends. I think it's June. It's a limited run. The show is very, very good. If you happen to be in New York City or going to New York City, I absolutely encourage you to check it out.
Now, it has changed, right, this play over the years. I mean, I would have loved to have seen the first version that lasted. I was the one scene. It's going after, what, midnight, and the people are in the audience are saying, hey, when is this thing going to end? But they stick around. That's the thing.
One of my favorite stories that we talked about in the book was about, you know, sort of one of the ongoing things that happens in the book is Tony Kushner's struggle to finish the second play, Perestroika.
Right.
His struggle to write it, and then once he's written it, his struggle to rewrite it and edit it so that it can be good. And the original draft of Perestroika is hundreds and hundreds of pages long, you know, 600 pages long. And, you know, then he's got to edit it and get it together. And the first time they do it in front of an audience, they're doing it as a kind of staged reading, and the play is so long that, you know, they started at 7 and it doesn't end until after midnight.
And you have a part of that. When you and Dan go and talk about the book and the play, you read some of your book, and you have a part there, don't you, about Tony Kushner and Perestroika and the writing of that?
Yeah, absolutely.
Can you share that?
Sure. I'm just going to read a little bit. This is Tony Kushner talking about writing Perestroika. Okay. So at this point in the story, he's written Millennium Approaches, the first half. Millennium Approaches is about to have its professional premiere, but he hasn't written the second half of the play yet. He's only got a little bit of it, and they don't know what's going to happen. So this is Tony Kushner talking. During that rehearsal period, someone on the board gave me their spider-infested cabin on the Russian River, and I went away for 10 days. It was early April, and I sat down, and I started writing. And I wrote 700 pages of Perestroika in 10 days. I just wrote the whole, you know, three times as much as would ultimately be in it, all by hand. It was literally like the Red Shoes. I could not stop writing. If I tried to go to sleep, I would wake up 2 minutes later and just go. And a lot of the best stuff that's in the play now was in that first draft. When I'd finished, I realized I had finished on my mother and father's wedding anniversary. And I'm not making this up. I get in the car to drive back, even though I hadn't slept in 11 days, and I was literally shaking from exhaustion. I didn't have a computer. It was just this big stack of legal paper, and I thought, if I go off the cliff into the Pacific Ocean, no one will ever know what happened. I have to be really careful. And I turned on the radio, and the first piece, I didn't even turn the knob. It was probably already set to a classical station, but I turned on the radio, and the first thing that came on was Mozart's Bassoon Concerto, which was one of my mother's practice pieces. And then the announcer came on, and then they started up with Mozart's Clarinet Concerto, which was my father's big practice piece. Then I went out of range of that station, so I turned the knob, and the first thing that came on was this song by the Black Crowes called She Talks to Angels. And then right after that, Simon and Garfunkel's We've All Come to Look for America, and then American Pie. I was not hallucinating at all. It was very real. That was an amazing day. And then later on, he talks about sort of some of the things that were in that version. There's a whole subplot about Belize forming a political group. There were many, many, many more hallucinations from Harper. In the 700-page really long version, there was a lot of stuff. I mean, something with a homeless kid, a chauffeur. God, there were like all these other characters. One of the reasons I could write for days without stopping is I was just, nobody ever has to know what I've done here.
Isaac Butler reading from Tony Kushner's account of his writing of Perestroika, the second half of the play of Angels in America. And, you know, throughout this thing, I don't know how religious or spiritual Tony Kushner is, but there's a sense in which there is a... This play itself does come from the threshold of revelation, doesn't it? I mean, there's so many things that are put together that fit together that are so true, that really have touched people. Well, let me put it into a question here: the effects of this play a little bit. Sure. Along through the account of your book, you come across a number of people who, and like yourself, who discovered this play and had their lives changed. What would you say is the contribution, if you could say it, between this play and people's understanding of what it means to be gay in America?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, I think that this play, in part, you know, by coming to Broadway, by being a success, by being beloved by the intelligentsia, I mean, it's not every play that gets discussed in multiple issues of the New York Review of Books. You know what I mean? It had a, like, really profound effect on shaping the cultural conversation back in a time when we should say it was easier to shape the cultural conversation because there was no internet, no social media, things like that, right? Those kind of monolithic turning of the battleship of our culture, there was a period of time where that was maybe in some ways easier to do if the right people were on board. But the other thing that I would say is that the play does to the people who see it and the people who are in it the same thing that it does to its characters. There's this kind of mimetic quality because the play is so long, right? It's such an epic experience. And because there's so much about the world packed into it, there's so much thematic density, and because it really takes this, its central characters beat by beat through the process of change and what it is to change and what the nature of change is and how change is inevitable and a necessary part of being alive, to interact with that is to be changed yourself. You can't really wade into those waters without being transformed in some way. At least that's my experience of it. I mean, I'm sure there's people who don't like this play who haven't had that experience of it. You know, it's not magical. It's not the baptismal fount or something, right? But it does have that effect on a lot of people that you just feel on some molecular level like you've been shifted by it, which is something that only great art can really do. Part of me feels like only theater can really do that, but that's because I'm a theater buff. But great art can really do that. And this play, through really being about change itself and the nature of change itself, and guiding you through that process, really has that effect on lots of people.
This is Progressive Spirit, progressivespirit.net. I'm speaking with Isaac Butler, co-author with Dan Coyes of The World Only Spins Forward, The Ascent of Angels in America. More to come. Stay with us. You're listening to the podcast version of Progressive Spirit. If you enjoy the show, please go to iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, Podomatic, TuneIn, or whatever podcast app you use to listen and give Progressive Spirit 5 stars, won't you? Contact me through progressivespirit.net with your thoughts and ideas about the show, and be sure to share this podcast on your social media. Follow on Facebook and Twitter. The website, again, is progressivespirit.net. You're listening to Progressive Spirit, progressivespirit.net, and I'm speaking with Isaac Butler. He, along with Dan Coyes, have written an oral history of the play Angels in America. Their book is called The World Only Spins Forward, The Ascent of Angels in America. And there is a reality sense to it. You know, I remember myself as a clergy and through the LGBT rights struggle and how it worked out with my particular denomination, the Presbyterians, and all of the things that needed to be said along the way. You know, for example, people would say, well, you know, all gay people are very nice. You know, they're trying to be helpful, but the right. Play's honesty was so beautiful. A 16-year-old straight kid taken to the play by his mother, and he comes out and he says, "Wow, I didn't know gays were assholes."
Yeah, that's a scene in the book. Yeah, exactly. You know, that is one of the things that the play also does, is that because the characters are very human, they're not idealized. You know, we often think that for something to have quote unquote good representational politics, you know, it has to have these kind of idealized, almost condescending visions of the people it's portraying. We hear that a lot in our culture when talking about so-called strong female characters. You know, what people actually want and what actually more successfully changes people's perception, I think, is to show people characters who are complicated and human and are flawed, even if they're good people and, you know, have their challenges, because then we can identify with them, because it's hard to identify with something that's, you know, someone who's idealized.
I had a hard time identifying with Lewis, and on the other hand, I also identified with him very well. His just angst, his lack of courage, and his guilt, and all of that, and it was amazing, really.
Right. Well, as a secular Jew myself, I identify with Lewis in all sorts of ways. But, you know, I and clearly Tony Kushner does too. That's one of the things. One of the people in our book says something like, all of us want to think that we are Pryor and Harper, but we're all really Joe and Lewis or something like that. And the truth of the matter is that we're all of those things. You know, there is the part of us that is brave and fierce and strong, but there's also the part of us that is scared and weak and can't make up our mind about anything. You know, Lewis does horrible things in this play. I mean, really horrible things. He abandons his lover of almost 5 years at the point when he is most needed. I mean, it is a truly unforgivable act. And he's not forgiven by the end of the play, which is interesting. But he muddles through. He figures out a new way to exist in the world. He changes and he grows and he learns something. And that's really powerful.
Lewis, you know, and Hannah and Pryor are hanging out there at the end, but Joe isn't there. He's the one who really doesn't get redemption, isn't it?
Yeah, Joe gets no redemption at all. And, you know, there's a section in our book where we talk about that because, you know, this probably won't be surprising, but the actors who play Joe really struggle with the fact that their character is left behind at the end of the play. That's a difficult thing if you're the actor playing Joe, you know, to know that your character is left behind and that there's what feels like a kind of judgment there. I will say I have many things I feel about that. One of them is that, you know, Joe begins the play kind of way further behind the other characters. It takes him an entire play to even admit that he's attracted to men. He's so in denial and so closed off. He's very much at the beginning of a process of change, and the other characters start the play further along than him. So to me, it makes a certain amount of sense that he's not all the way there at the end of the second play. I also think that, you know, the play is more honest for having at least one character who enters into a process of change and tries to live a more authentic life and does not end up better off for it. You know, the truth of the matter is the change isn't always good, and you can try to live a more authentic life and end up worse off. And I think that makes the play more honest. The other thing I'll say is that Lewis really comes to an important revelation at the end of that play when he says to Pryor, you know, failing at love is not the same as not loving, right? That he understands that he's failed, that he's not looking for absolution. And he's also not looking for saying, oh, I'm the worst person in the world and kind of expiating his guilt that way, you know, through wallowing in it. He's accepting what he's doing and he's trying to figure out a way forward and a way to be there with Pryor and to love Pryor, even though Pryor says to him explicitly, you can't come back at the end of the play. And I think those characters form a new friendship based on that at the end.
As you were talking, my thought immediately went to Meryl Streep playing the rabbi at the beginning. I mean, that was so rich to have the rabbi begin the play itself, you know, Welcome to the Home for Aged Hebrews, and how that really set the whole tone.
Yeah, you know, it's a really interesting way that the play begins. The play begins by acknowledging we're all in the same room together, you know, and then it welcomes you into this kind of New York Jewish 1980s universe that the play takes place in, and then connects these characters immediately to this deeper history, right? It's a beautiful monologue about, you know, you bring with you the clay of some Litvak shtetl, she says, right? That you are here in America because someone came here dragging their whole history behind with them.
I thought that was the best eulogy ever. I think it's, yeah. You know, no, it's not about the individual. It's about the story that's in all of us.
But it also has like a very particular vision of America. America as the melting pot where nothing melted, you know? Because a lot of the play is about identity. A lot of the play is about these characters and their different positionality that's defined by, you know, where they come from on an identity level and how do they communicate with each other and move forward and clash. Ultimately, I think the play has an optimistic vision both of the future of the AIDS crisis and the future of America. But it's a hard-won, embattled optimism that comes with really honestly wrestling with America and not like the way Jacob wrestles with the angel, you know, not a BS kind of America's the greatest, you know, rah-rah optimism, but a real optimism that comes from, you know, looking directly in the eye.
Talk to me about the Mormons and how this happened to be. Why not Southern Baptists?
Why not Southern Baptists? Well, you know, we have a whole chapter in the book about that. It's easy to understand why Roy Cohn would be in a play about gay men and AIDS, right? He was a gay man who died of AIDS. But what Mormonism was and why Mormonism became important to the play was something, you know, I think Tony Kushner himself had to figure out. And there were a number of things. Part of it has to do with the way that the Mormon church approaches homosexuality, which is not only that it is a sin, but that, like, it's not real. You know, there's a level of denial of homosexuality that is not unique to Mormonism, but is so powerful that it makes a lot of sense if you're going to have a closeted character. Like, why not push it all the way into this utter denial? The other thing is that, you know, there's only a few indigenous American Christian religions, right? There is something about it being a native to the United States religion. In particular, one that has an elaborate cosmology involving angels, and where angels can still visit America today, and where there are Latter-day Saints and a new revelation, right? And one of the things that happens in this play is that the main character is visited by an angel, you know, and given a Latter-day prophecy. And so I think when you're going to start wrestling with those themes, going to the religion that says those things are actually possible is going to be an interesting thing to read up on and is going to open a lot of doors for you. And then the other component of it was that Tony Kushner had a personal relationship with the Mormon church. He had a friend growing up who was Mormon. You know, he lived actually nearby a Mormon tabernacle or a Mormon outreach center. And, you know, there were a couple of local Mormon missionaries in Brooklyn who he knew, you know, so it's just something that intrigued him. And he wanted to go towards that and see what there was to find.
Yeah, because that idea of, you know, basically Jesus Christ comes to the United States. I mean, it is a revelation on the soil that makes Mormons really an American religion, and the angel and Moroni, and as well as the angel in the play. I mean, there's really quite a bit of richness through this. And of course, Hannah, it isn't all, you know, like dismissive of Mormonism, because Hannah actually discovers who she is quite a bit as she grows through it.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that is always intriguing to me about Hannah's character is that we don't really know what her, you know, the play ends with a jump forward in time to 1990. And Hannah, Pryor, Lewis, and Belize are all together in Central Park. But we don't learn in that scene what Hannah's feeling or approach to her Mormon faith at that point is. You know what I mean? Like, she is a devout Mormon through all of the play, as far as we know. But one of the things that the play, you know, gives us is this vision of this woman who changes for the better and who is able to accept and love a gay man, Pryor. You know, when she's Joe Pitt's mother, and when Joe Pitt first comes out of the closet to her, she is incredibly brutal to him. I mean, that scene is one of the, it's just an incredibly hard scene. I don't remember the exact line, but she says something like, you know, you're old enough to know your father didn't love you without getting crazy about it, or something like that, you know? I mean, she says incredibly cruel things. But, you know, When she meets Pryor, something changes about her. And as she, you know, helps Pryor, Pryor has a health emergency, she helps Pryor get to the hospital. You know, as she gets to know him, there is a change in her. She learns from that, from getting to know him, she becomes less homophobic. She becomes more accepting of gays in a way that I feel like to some extent predicts or presages the way that as more and more gay people came out of the closet and as gay marriage became a mainstream issue, gays and lesbians became far more accepted, right? You know, once people actually, you know, that was the sort of secret weapon of the gay marriage movement, is that once people, and of coming out of the closet, once people actually got to know gays and lesbians, many of them realized how incredibly stupid homophobia and legal policies against gays and lesbians actually are. You know, it's hard when like your coworker you really like comes out of the closet to you and tells you he or she's gay. It's hard to like maintain all of your hatred and prejudice in the face of that. And I know many, many people who, you know, 20 years ago, 25 years ago, were deeply homophobic, deeply suspicious of gays and lesbians, did not care that gays and lesbians couldn't get married or couldn't adopt kids, made fun of gays and lesbians and stuff like that. And their opinions of gays and lesbians have entirely changed as a result of getting to know real flesh and blood human beings. You know, one thing the closet allowed was it allowed for a myth of what a gay person actually was like. And as long as that myth was all you knew, you didn't have to deal with any contrary information. You didn't have to change your opinion. But once you actually know real flesh and blood human beings impacted by this stuff, it causes a radical shift. It was one of the most brilliant things about Harvey Milk as an organizer in the late 70s was his realization that everyone needed to come out of the closet.
Yeah, and the only thing that can keep homophobia going after someone comes out to you, your friend, is religion, which is why, obviously, it had to be central to this play.
Yeah, absolutely. And the thing you have to remember about Ronald Reagan, which maybe not all your listeners will remember, is that Ronald Reagan is the one who gave the religious right a seat at the table in the Republican Party, mm-hmm. right? The religious right arises in the 70s as a response to some specific things going on, like that the government was going to forcibly desegregate religious schools. You know, or the other social issues like abortion and the specter of gay rights, which, you know, was just starting then. But then you have that the religious right organizing as a political force. And it's Reagan who capitalizes on that. You know, he becomes the religious rights guy. He gives them a seat at the table. And that has utterly transformed Republican and American politics for the worse, as we've now seen. You know, there is no way you're going to write about the AIDS crisis, particularly, and about gays in America and not cover specifically the Christian faith in America.
I want to go back to the beginning. Sure. I'm thinking of, there's a quote, F. Murray Abraham, who played Roy Cohn in the original Broadway play. Is that right?
He replaced Ron Liebman. He was in the replacement cast. So on Broadway, when a show runs for a certain amount of time, actors start dropping out, new actors come in. And when Ron Liebman, who played Roy Cohn, left the production, F. Murray Abraham, who at that point was best known for his Oscar-winning performances, Salieri and Amadeus, took over the role.
Right. Okay. And so when he says that when he did The Ritz, this was before that 80% of the cast had died of AIDS. And I thought, we've forgotten, maybe those of us, I'm not saying we've forgotten, but many people in America might have forgotten really how frightening that was, how death-dealing. Tell me a little bit more about that. What was really the situation when Tony Kushner wrote his play?
Well, thank you for asking me that. You know, the whole first chapter of the book is sort of about first couple chapters, we're trying to outline some of that. The AIDS crisis is a very specific and particular moment in world, but also American history. And if you think about it, for those of us who lived through it, if you think about it from the perspective of someone who hasn't, it's really peculiar. There's a new disease, right? There's a new plague that's almost universally fatal. When it starts, no one knows what causes it. No one knows how it's transmitted. No one knows how to stop it. No one knows whether it's a virus or not. No one knows anything about it, right? And that disease, that new plague, very specifically spreads amongst the most ostracized, hated communities in America, which is to say, you know, gays and lesbians, but particularly when it was first starting out, gay men and heroin users. You know,
yeah.
These are communities that are often outside of cities, especially relegated to the shadows, who don't have a lot of, as Roy Cohn says in the play, don't have a lot of clout, you know, and it spreads like wildfire through those communities, because, again, by the time anyone knows what causes it, huge percentage of people are infected with it already. Because there's a time lapse between when you contract the disease and when you get sick. Not only that, because it's an immunodeficiency disease, the way the disease presents is through you catching other diseases, right? AIDS, remember, is a syndrome. AIDS is a list of symptoms that taken together mean that you have it. And the most, you know, sort of famous of those diseases is Kaposi sarcoma, which causes purple lesions to appear on your body. So the thing is that once you got one of those lesions, they're very visible, and you are outed as having AIDS, which means you're outed as well as likely being gay or a drug addict, you know? That's only the social problems. There's more social problems than that. Getting appropriate medical care was incredibly difficult. There were hospitals that wouldn't take AIDS patients. They didn't know what to do with AIDS patients once they had them. Kaposi sarcoma, it could stay on your skin and be relatively harmless, or you could get a lesion in your eyes and go blind. You could get lesions in your lungs and you'd suffocate, you know? So it was an incredibly terrifying disease, and it was particularly destructive to the world of theater, because theater had always been a haven for queer people. And there were a lot of gays and lesbians in the theater community. And so the disease wreaked, HIV wreaked incredible havoc in the theater community. I mean, that's what F. Murray is referencing there about the cast of the Ritz and, you know, 80% of them dying. One of the guys who designed the wings for the Angel in Angels in America died of AIDS. One of the original actors who played Roy Cohn in Angels in America died of AIDS. A guy named Rick Frank. Famous director Michael Bennett, who directed a Chorus Line, died of AIDS. You know what I mean? And this is still going on today. I mean, Michael Friedman, who was a friend of mine and a composer who composed a Bloody Bloody Andrew Jackson, which was on Broadway a few years ago, Michael just died of AIDS recently. You know, so the theater community still faces those kinds of losses. It's hard if you didn't live through it or if you weren't personally connected to it to remember or to understand how terrifying and traumatizing that time was. People who did live through it regularly compare it to the Holocaust. They'll talk about themselves because the psychology that they have found that is recognizable to their own psychology is that of Holocaust survivors. I mean, that's the level of trauma that I think people feel that they went through.
And then the judgment laid out upon it, you know, of people thinking, well, this is a punishment from God.
It's a punishment from God, or, you know, you just have to not have sex. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, that's easy for human beings to do. Or that it was funny because it affected gays and, you know, gays are funny. Yeah. I mean, the homophobia and embrace of the religious right of the Reagan Revolution, combined with the conservatives' contempt for government and the belief that the government sort of was incapable of doing good and the desire to cut the government back, those two things intersected in the worst possible ways. And, you know, one of the things for me that the story of the AIDS crisis to me is also the story of the failure of the Republican theory of government. There is no way to study or think about the AIDS crisis and come away from that believing that the conservative, particularly the post-Reagan conservative view of how the government should work is true. The AIDS crisis is just a, you know, you don't even need anything else than that. The AIDS crisis is a refutation of that entire worldview. We do need the government. We do need to care for each other. We do need to help people, even if we find them distasteful. The only way to manage a large crisis like this is with government intervention.
I'm speaking with Isaac Butler. The World Only Spins Forward, The Ascent of Angels in America is an oral history of the play Angels in America. So we're going to end this on politics, too, now with a new president. What does this mean, Angels in America now? Does it still have a political message?
Oh, boy, does it ever. You know, one of the interesting things was that when we started reporting the article that would turn into this book, Donald Trump was a joke. We got about halfway through working on the book, and he was the next president of the United States, you know? And that radically changed the book. I think it radically changed the nature of the book. Our interviews with people went from people kind of talking in abstract terms about the relevance of this play today to people talking in direct concrete terms about the relevance of this play today. For a couple of reasons. As I said before, Roy Cohn, who's a character in this play, was Donald Trump's mentor. And Donald Trump learned his tactics of always lash out, always attack, never admit you're wrong, lie when you have to, you know, bludgeon your way through the system. He learned that directly from Roy Cohn. So that's one immediate thing. The other thing I would say is that, you know, as Tony Kushner says in our book, the play was not written at a time of great positive change. The play was written and takes place in a time when things are terrible, but there's glimmers of hope. There's little shoots of grass, you know, peeking through that sort of concrete that's been laid over it. And that is very similar to the time we live in now, you know? And I think the play's central struggle, which is between kind of reactionary forces that want to hold the world back and keep us from changing, no matter how much destruction that causes, and the understanding that, as our book's title says, the world only spins forward, we are moving forward, we are changing, we have to work to change for the better. That struggle is always going to be the struggle we're in because we're human, but it's a particular struggle right now under Trump. I would also say that, you know, the play ends with Pryor Walter giving this speech to the audience in which he says, you know, we will be citizens. The time is now. Now, he is talking about people with AIDS and gay men in the original context of that play. We will be citizens. But I think now when we hear that line, when we read that line, when we think about that line, it is a call for us to think about the nature of citizenship and who gets to be a citizen and who doesn't, and to rethink that more expansively, more empathetically, and more bravely. That is what the play is calling for us to do at the end. And you know, the fight for full citizenship for the LGBTQ community is far from over. You can still be legally fired for being transgender in most states. You can still be legally fired for being gay in some states, you know? But beyond that, it is also calling on us to look at citizenship expansively once again. That is the only response we can have to something as horrible as Trump is to run towards the opposite and embrace it as hopefully, as fully, and as bravely as we can.
Isaac Butler has been my guest, author of The World Only Spins Forward, The Ascent of Angels in America, an oral history. Isaac, thank you so much for your insights on this play. It was fantastic.
Oh, wow. Well, thank you so much for having me.
You've been listening to Progressive Spirit. ProgressiveSpirit.net is the website and the place to go for podcasts. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Progressive Spirit is produced in the studios of KBOO in Portland, Oregon. I'm John Schuck. Be well.